I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Consumers went shopping in near record numbers this past holiday weekend, but on Saturday, the nation's largest retailer, Walmart, revised its holiday shopping projections downward. National Retail Federation spokeswoman Ellen Tolley says the high cost of energy dampened sales at discounters like Walmart.
Higher gas prices are affecting some customers. Higher gas prices and higher energy costs are affecting consumers with very fixed discretionary incomes. Those consumers are the ones most likely to shop at discounters.
On the other hand, Saks Fifth Avenue is reportedly having a hard time keeping in stock a $1,000 Dolce & Gabbana handbag with matching $500 belt buckle. Not the belt, just the buckle. New York Times Wall Street columnist Gretchen Morgenson joins us now. And Gretchen, when we spoke last week, you said the first weekend of holiday shopping numbers, it's not the whole picture of the economy. But was it a good or bad weekend for shoppers or for the economy?
Well, Robin, it's interesting that Walmart is having difficulties. This year is the first year that the company has experienced some drop-off in its sales. And I think what it probably represents is sort of the growing disparity in wealth in the country, i.e., you see the Saks Fifth Avenue story that you mentioned up at the top there and others, Neiman Marcus doing well, and the Walmarts of the world not doing so well. I think it only reflects what we've seen elsewhere, which is that we have more millionaires than ever, but we also have a lot of folks out there who have trouble making ends meet.
Now, I'm reading some analysis that says that because it's the low end of the economy, families that are affected by energy prices, for instance, and more low-income households, that the economy won't feel it as much because the higher-end spenders spend four times as much.
Well, I don't know if that's right. It could very well be, but I do think that it is going to be a problem if we have this sort of increasing wage gap or spending gap that seems to be occurring. I think another piece of the puzzle for people who are in the lower end of the spectrum are heavy, heavy indebtedness. We have seen just an amazing growth in debt and an amazing decline in savings in this country, and that really has to hurt people who are, you know, in the vice and squeezed as now like never before, thanks to gas prices.
Right. We're seeing some of the statistics that came out of the weekend. Visa and MasterCard said use of their cards to purchase gifts is up this year by 14% for Visa.
That is a very, very amazing number. And I think it will continue, but I think that it has a big IOU at the end of the line. We have a savings rate in this country which is 0.2% as of September 2004. That is amazing compared to an already depressed level of almost 5% in 1995, okay? 5% to 0.2% in 2004, less than 10 years. That is going to have huge consequences, Robin.
It's also compared to other countries, countries in Europe, for instance, which have much higher saving rates, I understand.
Yes, and what is happening is the U.S. Shopper is just out there spending, and consuming. U.S. personal consumption expenditures averaged 3.9% annually, and that's a growth rate that's nearly double the 2.2% pace recorded elsewhere in the so-called first world. So we are major shoppers, but again, if we don't have the savings to pay for it, that's going to come and haunt us in years to come.
Well, Gretchen, we know today that President Bush has chosen a new Commerce Secretary, Carlos Gutierrez, Chief Executive Officer of Kellogg. A little bit about him, and also your thoughts on the expected changes in the area of the economy that President Bush is expected to make to have his people more in line with his economic message.
I think the appointment of Mr. Gutierrez is reflective of President Bush's commitment to the Hispanic sector, and he, I believe, is the only CEO of a Fortune 500 company that is of Hispanic descent, so I think that's perfectly in keeping with that. But as far as what the president and his advisors can do about the economy, he's got a lot of problems on his plate right now. He certainly has to make the deficit decline. line. They're talking about a weaker dollar and helping do that. So I think that he's really got some major troubles to look at in his second term. He also wants to try to make sure that the economy continues to trend upward. A lot of people feel that it is in a very sort of weak state, and that's not good for him. So how to do that, I'm not exactly sure, given that he's done a lot in the way of tax breaks already.
And Gretchen, what about the concerns of the discounters? The average shopper at Walmart, we understand, makes about $35,000 a year. A huge chunk of that goes to heat and energy costs. As we head into Christmas and higher heat and energy costs,
well, there's really nothing that the president or anyone else in this nation can do about higher energy costs. Prices have gone up, and they're likely going to stay up. So this is a fact of life that's going to be around for a while to come. It is a tax on the lower-income people who use their cars to commute more than the upper-income people do. I think that it really will continue to have reverberations.
Gretchen Morgenson, columnist for The New York Times. Gretchen, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
Travelers to North Korea are reporting that portraits of the leader Kim Jong-il have disappeared from key sites. Well, joining us first for a look at North Korea, Gordon Faircloth. He's South Korean reporter for the Asian Wall Street Journal. And Gordon, remind us, what's the importance of the image of Kim Jong-il and his father, Kim Il-sung?
Well, there's an incredible cult of personality in North Korea. Kim Jong-il is the son of the founder of this Stalinist dynasty, if you will, who really created North Korea in the aftermath of World War II. And Kim Jong-il succeeded after his father's death in 1994. But it's just incredibly pervasive, Robin. Officials in North Korea, in fact, almost every person in North Korea wears a lapel pin with a picture of one or both of the Kims. Pictures of these two men are literally everywhere. Statues as well. It's quite something when you go.
We understand that Kim is considered a demigod, and that any kind of affront to an image, even spilling water on a newspaper picture of him, is highly punishable.
That's right. I actually interviewed one escapee from North Korea here in Seoul now, made his way to Seoul, who says that his sister actually perished in a fire while trying to rescue a picture of Kim Jong-il.
This is the woman who was, you know, elevated to national hero, right?
That's right. Yes, doing something bad to a portrait is a punishable offense, and rescuing one is a sure way to win the praise of the regime. There was a worker at a construction project in North Korea where they were building a series of power plants that was part of the last deal to try to prevent North Korea from getting nuclear weapons. A worker on that construction project who was a foreign visitor, actually a South Korean, had tossed a copy of the newspaper into the trash. There was a picture on the front page of the newspaper of Kim Jong-il, as is often the case in North Korea. And when the cleaning woman found it, of course, she dropped a dime on the guy and called the police. And the work on the entire project stopped for a while diplomats flew over from the U.S. to negotiate the release of the South Korean.
So when did the rumors of the pictures disappearing from walls, for instance, when did those rumors start?
That's been a couple of weeks now, and I think it originated with a report from TASS, the Russian wire service, quoting an unnamed diplomat. It does seem that there are at least a few locations where there's now only a picture of the father and not of the son. And these areas, it seems to me, are mostly places where the government entertains foreigners and has foreign dignitaries. We all, of course, say in the media and the punditocracy, you know, flew into action at this report. I think we're also kind of desperate and interested that there might be some kind of change going on up there. But officials that I've spoken to, intelligence officials, both in South Korea and the United States, say they don't really see any signs of shift in the power dynamics in the regime at this point. You know, it could be something as benign as changing the portraits to one where he's wearing a new suit, or it could be part of a calculated effort to try to, you know, kind of lessen the image of the personality cult, at least in the eyes of foreigners. There certainly have been a lot of reports among regular North Koreans and places where North Koreans go. There certainly has been no wholesale removal of Kim Jong-il portraits.
Gordon Fairclough, South Korean reporter for the Asian Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Seoul, South Korea. Gordon, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, perhaps Kim Jong-il just wants to update his portrait. Perhaps he's looking to upgrade his image. Joining us now, Han Park. He's a professor of political science at the University of Georgia. He's visited North Korea dozens of times. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
And as you know, in the Soviet Union, the word Kremlinology meant trying to figure out what was going on inside a secretive regime based only on clues such as the placement of portraits. So can you apply Kremlinology to Pyongyang? What's going on?
Yeah, normally, one might be led to believe that taking down of the Kim Jong-il's portrait may suggest that his power may be challenged or perhaps demised. But in this case, I don't think that is correct. And I think there is absolutely no indication whatsoever about possibility of his power being threatened or demised.
Well, in fact, we just heard from reporter Gordon Fairclough in South Korea saying that, you know, the disappearance of the portraits could simply mean that he's got a new picture with a new suit, and it could be that simple. But there are other things that people are pointing to, the defection of generals, the fact that Kim hasn't been seen a lot recently. There were reports of anti-government posters being placed around in North Korea, something unheard of. You don't think that adds up?
Anti-government posters have been allegedly posted on and off all these years. But certainly the level of dissension is such that no articulation of interest or aggregation of dissension may lead to any kind of coup against the leadership. That's unthinkable. It's impossible at this time.
Well, even though I just want to point to one other comment made by the acting Secretary General of the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan. He said, again, in response to the pictures, the disappearance of the pictures, he said that I think we should consider the possibility that a regime change will occur, and we need to start simulations of what we should do at that time. So he's speculating that it might be coming.
And I think that's from the Japanese leading party's point of view, somewhat wishful thinking.
Yeah.
I think what really might have been the case is Kim Jong-il, unlike his father, represents a new kind of younger generation. He's much better informed of outside the world, the international market, and so on. And he is very sensitive how he's perceived by the outside.
Han Park, professor of political science at the University of Georgia and a career watcher. When we come back, more of what Professor Park sees in recent news out of the North and how it might impact any possible resolution of the current Korean nuclear standoff. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been learning about North Korea. Reports that portraits of the dear leader Kim Jong-il have been removed from walls in that region have set off waves of speculation. Han Park is a professor of political science at the University of Georgia, and he's a frequent visitor to North Korea. And, Professor, there are also reports that Kim himself told officials, "Don't exalt me," that he's trying to be, you know, perhaps a normal guy in advance of possible new claims of human rights violations. And also today, reports that North Korea asked the five U.N. agencies in the country to cut their staff. Now, they've been there since the famine 9 years ago that killed millions. They were there to help the people, but also ensure that the food aid went to the people and not to the army. So what does the order to cut the staffs mean to you?
I think they're playing just a hard ball. They're not going to be pressed by outside, even including the United Nations. when it comes to the mode of distribution of food coming in, to them it is a domestic internal affair. And they have been very resistant to the thinking that the food might be distributed to the military. They have been claiming that they're concerned about their citizens, their starvation of the civilians, more so than outsiders are concerned about them. Mm.
Well, Professor, today leaders in China, Japan, and South Korea vowed to strengthen their cooperation to resolve the crisis over North Korea's nuclear programs.
Mm-hmm.
What is the likelihood that the talks over that, especially the six-nation talks, that included Russia and the United States and the two Koreas,
mm-hmm.
are going to be jump-started?
And I think the North Korean position is not expected to change, and that is North Korea demands some sort of security assurance from the United States. They feel security threatened only from the American source. So, in fact, China, South Korea, Japan belatedly joined, and Russia and these outside the United States, these countries, in fact, are demanding Washington to come up with a more reasonable or a realistic proposal. Mm-hmm. Presently, there is no proposal. The proposal that we have from Washington is, in fact, telling North Korea to give in everything before we do any consideration of providing economic aid or security mm-hmm. assurance. So, you know, first of all these neighboring countries desperately want North Korean nuclear issues alleviated peacefully. Once North Korea becomes nuclear, Japan would have to go nuclear. Then China will be agitated by that, do something. Taiwan, South Korea, then East Asian arms race in the area of nuclear armament will ensue.
Well, you say once North Korea becomes nuclear, U.S. officials say Pyongyang may have one or two nuclear bombs already and enough material for another six.
Yeah, they may have, in fact, already five, six. But there are high degree of uncertainty about their deliverability. These weapons, in fact, even if they have, can that be fit in missiles warhead? Can it be actually used? In fact, if they, when I said when it, North Korea goes nuclear, I mean testing nuclear in public.
Mm. Ah, I see.
That would mean that East Asian arms race will be triggered, and North Korea, in fact, ironically, will be fearful of that possibility because North Korea doesn't have the kind of economic base to compete with neighboring countries in the arms race.
Mm. Professor, as a longtime watcher of Kim Jong-il, this is a man who's very odd. You know, his people are poor. He eats, you know, lobsters that are airlifted to his train with silver chopsticks. He loves movies and kidnapped a South Korean film director in 1978 to be able to talk to him about films. You have a sense of what he's thinking and what he might do?
Actually, I don't know. But what I do know is he's surrounded by people. Those people may have blindfolded him. Usually a political leader, even in a democratic system, may be blindfolded by his yes-men surrounding the central figure. And I think North Korea, that may have been the case. But of late, he has a clearer understanding of the outside world and starvations at home and so forth. So much so that he assumed the deeply humiliating situation when he admitted the abduction of Japanese citizens to the visiting Prime Minister of Japan, Koizumi.
This happened in the 70s.
The abductions, 70s mostly.
Mm-hmm.
He attributed that to old guards, old generations. So that suggested to me that this man is interested in working with other leaders around the world and be much more pragmatic. And that means also he has a power base very solidified. No matter what he does, that may not be very pleasant to the people in North Korea. But still, his power is not going to be threatened by that.
Han Park, professor of political science at the University of Georgia. indicating that the metaphorical blindfold on Kim Jong-il has been removed. Professor, thank you.
You are quite welcome.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and your town. And tomorrow on Here and Now, telling the story of the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, how the media has been defying the state. That's tomorrow. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Rwandan officials are denying today's Associated Press reports that thousands of Rwandan troops have crossed into neighboring Congo in an attempt to disarm Hutu rebels. Rwanda has invaded Congo twice since 1996 on the grounds of flushing out Hutus responsible for the 1994 slaughter of Tutsis. It's a story of genocide that still reverberates in Rwanda and is now coming to theaters in America. A new film called Hotel Rwanda tells of the hotel manager who offered sanctuary to over 1,000 terrified Tutsi refugees. In this scene from the film, the manager, Paul Rusesabagina, played by American actor Don Cheadle, listens to the radio with his petrified family and staff. They hear the news that the Rwandan president has been killed, allegedly by Tutsis, and they hear the call for retribution.
Listen to me, good people of Rwanda. Terrible news. Our great president is murdered by the Tutsi cockroaches. They tricked him to sign their phony peace agreement. Then they shot his plane from the sky. It is time to clear the brush, good Hutus of Rwanda.
Paul Rusesabagina becomes a savior, a Schindler-like character during the Rwandan genocide. In the end, he saves the lives of over 1,200 men, women, and children. Hotel Rwanda was directed and co-written by filmmaker Terry George. It's a pleasure to have both. Terry, hello.
Thank you.
And the real-life Paul Rusesabagina in our studios. Hello to you, Paul.
I'm fine.
And you know, and when I met you a few minutes ago, it's very emotional to meet you. You are quite a hero. With this movie coming out, do you feel this sense of appreciation for what you did?
The ovation after each and every screening, people are receptive to the message we are conveying.
We want to find out what that message is, but you are a Hutu. Your wife is a Tutsi. You're in the home in that opening scene where you hear on the radio about the death of the president. The militia arrives. You're useful to a military man because you can help his soldiers get rooms at the hotel. He drives you and your family there. You bribe him several times to save their lives. But I want to ask you, do you remember those first horrific hours of the slaughter? as you drive to that hotel during that day, what were you thinking? What were you seeing?
Well, already from home because we were stranded, and I stayed in my house for 3 days before being evacuated from my house to the hotel. I had about 26 refugees, as you can see in the movie. And those refugees, I couldn't leave them at my home. I took them as my family. And on my way, on the streets and the roads, we were seeing dead bodies. And at about 1.5 kilometers, I was stopped by the captain who came to take us from home to the hotel. And he handed me a gun and told me, kill all of these cockroaches of yours.
And this was your wife, your children, her family?
And I had to negotiate with them for about 2 hours.
And you did. You used your wiles on your feet. Later, you got money from the safe at the hotel and began paying off the Hutu militia.
They wanted money from each and everyone. But I told them, look, you are asking them what they don't have. The only person who has got money, and me, I have money in the safe
of
the hotel.
Boy, I mean, just such bravery. And also, Terry, I'm thinking, as I'm watching those scenes, well, he could have given them the money and they could have killed him and the story would have been over right there. When you first heard Paul's story, your thoughts about what he did?
Well, obviously, you know, it struck me right away that this was the heroism epitomized in it was amplified even more by the fact that here was an ordinary man who took the skills that he would learn and obviously was very good at as a hotelier and turned that into this amazing feat of bargaining with killers and army generals and persuading them and dissuading them in order to save all the refugees who had fled to his hotel.
Mm. Paul, tell us about that, because it's one thing you brought your family and your neighbors to the hotel as the slaughter's continuing around the hotel. What then happened? How did other people know to come there?
Well, when I arrived in the hotel, there were some refugees already. Mm-hmm. And the ones I knew where they were still hiding, I sent them. I tried to organize and send them soldiers to go and bring them to the hotel.
Mm. I want to play a clip from the movie Hotel Rwanda. And in this scene, Paul, the character that is you, finds out that the Hutu army wants to kill not only the men and women, but the children as well. Let's listen.
They're targeting Tutsi children, Paul, to wipe out the next generation. I've nowhere to take the orphans, Paul.
Don't worry. There will be an intervention force coming soon, and we will get the orphans out of them.
Paul, did you and other Rwandans think that someone would come and help you, that there would be intervention?
Well, from the day that the United Nations pulled out, there was no more hope. I know I will die. That one I was sure. Mm-hmm. They will kill me before killing these people because they knew I was the only person protecting the refugees. But before I die, I was supposed to go up to the end of my strength. I said, I won't give up.
Right. Well, as you said, the UN and international peacekeeping forces did leave days after that conversation. The U.S. didn't intervene. Belgium, South Africa, every country now is ashamed of what they didn't do then. But what did you do? How did you had thousands of hundred men and women and children in your hotel. What did you do?
Well, I was facing a lot of problems. I was trying to get food. I was rationing water because I knew it was the only treasure which was remaining for us.
Paul Rusesabagina, you bluffed your way for 100 days. In the final moments, you and 1,200 refugees were rounded up for execution, but we're not going to tell the real-life ending. Suffice it to say, you did not lose a single soul, even though a million Rwandans were slaughtered outside of the hotel. You say you now have a message. What is that?
I know that the average citizen of each and every nation in the Western world is not informed of what happened in Rwanda, is not informed of what is happening right now in Sudan. They are not informed of what is happening in Congo, where people have been butchered for the last 80 years. It is the same thing in northern Uganda and Burundi. This movie, I take it as a kind of wake-up call to our consciences so that we can prepare a better world for the next generations.
Terry, just a last thought. Just watching the movie, a lot of people in the West could comfort themselves with the thought that, oh, well, these were people who fight all the time, and it's Africa. In your film, you see this beautiful man in his suit and tie working at a hotel with his lovely family. They look like us.
When I visited Kigali, I saw that, and that's what I wanted to recreate, that this was not two bunch of savages, you know, killing each other with machetes and clubs. This was a growing country. Paul led a sophisticated, westernized life. There were many people like him. And suddenly, this complex political situation, manipulated by hate radio, turned a civil war into a genocide. And that's the purpose of the film, to take people inside that and follow through the genocide, through this terrible event, with one man who gives us hope and inspiration.
Terry George's film is called Hotel Rwanda. It tells the story of Paul Rusesabagina, the inspiration for the film. Paul, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
It's a remarkable story. Terry, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Hotel Rwanda is now on the film festival circuit. It opens nationwide at the end of the month. You're listening to Here and Now. One of the biggest obstacles to prosecuting gang-related crime nationwide in the U.S. is the intimidation of victims and witnesses. In fact, prosecutors in Suffolk County in Massachusetts say witnesses are threatened in some 90% of such crimes. Well, Here Now's Athena Desai reports on one attempt to provide better protection for people who come forward to testify.
Behind a trio of men in suits in the center of this Beacon Hill hearing room, people start to fill up wooden chairs and lean against the walls. The man in the middle with nickel-colored hair is Suffolk District Attorney Daniel Conley, the first to testify on the intimidation of victims and witnesses in gun and gang-related crimes.
It's an issue that has never received the full attention it deserves, and as a result, is now one of the most prevalent, insidious problems in the criminal justice system.
Just in what police call crime hotspots in Roxbury, Mattapan, and Dorchester last year, there were roughly 120 shootings. So for the hundreds of shootings across Suffolk County, Conley estimates victims and witnesses are too scared to cooperate with police or prosecutors 90% of the time. The DA describes the kind of situation that fuels that fear.
In one case, a few years ago, a woman was called to testify against a gang member charged with a shooting. When she entered the courtroom, the benches were filled with the friends of the defendant, and she turned right around and she left the courtroom. She cried to the victim witness advocate in my office that she might as well have put a bullseye on her back, and she did not testify.
People who've experienced such intimidation are so fearful that no one would be interviewed for this story, even with the assurance of anonymity and voice alteration. Intimidation comes in many forms, being followed, repeated hang-ups on the phone, a dead animal at the front door, or seeing grand jury minutes or testimony with your name and address in it posted in your neighborhood. The DA wants to make that a punishable crime because prosecutors depend so much on witnesses.
They carry all the weight.
Rafi Yassin is chief prosecutor of the gang unit. Every non-fatal Suffolk County shooting is assigned to his office.
I mean, if you're investigating a shooting case, there's not a whole lot of science involved in some of these as far as forensic evidence to identify somebody. You may have forensic evidence that links a gun to the incident, ammunition to the incident, or something like that. But generally speaking, that type of a case is going to rely heavily on eyewitness testimony, whether it's the victim or the witness.
The courts fail to get a conviction in the majority of gun violence cases because of faulty, recanted, or non-existent testimony. Prosecutors acknowledge they have a lot working against them. For instance, the sweeping distrust of law enforcement in communities with high crime rates, stemming in part from bad experiences with police and the criminal justice system. And then there are factors far beyond the long arm of the law. The long arm of culture. Listen to this song, Rough Riders Anthem by DMX. It hit the charts in 1998, and last year, it was one of the top 10 most downloaded ringtones for cellular phones. That's how rough riders roll. Stop acting like a baby. Mind your business, lady. Nosy people get it too. When you see me spit it,
choose. You know I'm trying to get rid of you. Yeah, I know it's pitiful.
In DA Conley's office, they call it the snitch factor. Or as one assistant district attorney puts it, being unwilling to sell someone else up the river. Suffolk County prosecutors have found videos and CDs produced by defendants that have the same stop snitching message. Testifying in front of a grand jury is considered the height of snitching, hence the proposed legislation making it a crime to scare people away from testifying. But how do you fight that kind of mindset? And how effective might this law be for those who've already flouted laws against violence? Victim and witness advocate Reba Danestorg is one of the faith-based partners of the district attorney's office. She says you'd have to raise awareness of the proposed law and use it as an incentive.
With a law like that, you are now able to at least kind of offer the carrot, and you're able to say to someone, here are the things we have in place to keep you safe.
The DA's office has been lobbying lawmakers to shore up support for the legislative package. If the legislation gets signed into law, advocates could then push for resources to make sure victims and witnesses of gun or gang-related crimes get all the protection they need.
Here now, reporter Athena Desai, more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With this news note, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided not to hear a case which challenged the rights of gay couples to marry in Massachusetts. Conservative groups had asked the court to overturn a Massachusetts Supreme Court decision that legalized gay marriage last year. Voters in the Bay State may have a chance next year to change the state's constitution. In the past year, at least 3,000 couples have married. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to comment on why it's not hearing that case. Katherine Patterson has been writing fiction for children for over 30 years. In 1978, she received the Newbery Medal for her book Bridge to Terabithia, a novel about a young boy dealing with the death of his best friend. But despite Patterson's enduring popularity with young readers, her books continue to be criticized by some as anti-religious. The American Library Association has ranked Bridge to Terabithia among its top 10 most frequently challenged books. And Katherine Patterson joins us in the studio to talk about religion in children's literature. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Boy, top 10.
Well, I got bumped off the top 10 for several years because there were so many Harry Potter books on the top 10 that it moved me down, which was a great relief. But Then they decided to lump all the Harry Potter books, and so I'm back up in the top 10.
It opened up more spaces.
Of course,
a lot on the religious light, right, and others who are profoundly religious don't like the Harry Potter books because of the sorcery.
That's right.
Right. But your books, tell me first of all, this book, it sounds so lovely, young person coping with the death of another. What is it about the book that the religious right doesn't like?
Well, it changed slightly over the years, because it's been challenged for a long time. And initially, it was that the boy talks like children in his area talk. He uses the word Lord sort of as an interjection in his speech. And after his best friend dies, his father says, it's hell, ain't it? And there are a couple of dams in there. So it was language initially.
Mm-hmm.
Then the children built an imaginary kingdom in the woods, which they call Terabithia. And so it was supposed to be secular humanism. And before that was finished, then it was spirit worship and the occult, which, you know, it's just children's imaginary kingdom. Children who've read a lot of books and who use their imagination.
Well, the people who are critical of that say your books are thusly critical of organized religion and a doctrine-based idea of faith. And parents worry, you know, this is a time young people are trying to figure out what their faith is, and they're worried that you're going to pull them in the wrong direction with that kind of writing.
Well, I'm very sympathetic. I had four children myself and seven grandchildren, and I care. The world is not on the side of parents for the most part. But it makes me sad that anything that's imaginative is suspect. If you don't have any imagination, I don't see how you can have even faith, because faith depends on belief in what is invisible. Mm. And if you have no imagination, how can you even imagine God?
Mm. Well, what did you imagine Terabithia to be? What was it supposed to be?
Well, it was supposed to be that safe place. And as a child, it's usually outside yourself where you go to play out your fantasies and to be alone, or if you're very, very lucky, with a very close friend. Mm-hmm. And I moved a lot as a child. I always had some place I could go to do this. And I've often said to children, you know, if you don't have any place like that outside yourself when you're young, you probably don't have a place inside yourself when you're old mm-hmm. to go to. And people don't understand that very well.
Well, it's funny. You mentioned that you moved a lot yourself as uh-huh. a kid. You were a child of missionaries. Your parents were missionaries in China. Do you have a religious background? I mean,
My word, yes.
Well, it would seem so.
Yes, I was raised in a conservative Presbyterian home. We lived in China for the first mostly 8 years of my life. And then my father was a pastor in this country. I graduated from a conservative Presbyterian college. I've had 3 years of seminary. I was a missionary myself in China, in Japan, for 4 years. So, and I've been married to a minister for 42 years. I have quite a strong religious background.
Yeah, it would seem you would have the credentials to also. Have you ever thought of writing, a book that was deeply faith-based to sort of assuage those who question you?
Well, actually, my first book I wrote because the Presbyterian Church asked me to write a book about the Christian faith for fifth and sixth graders. That's how I began writing. Mm. I wrote a book called Who Am I? For children thinking about matters of faith. That book has been revised and reissued by Erdmans, which is a conservative Dutch Reformed press, Christian Reformed. And when people ask me about it, I say, well, it's propaganda. It's sharing what I believe, and I hope it's good propaganda, but it's quite different from writing a story, because with a story you don't begin with answers, you begin with questions. Mm. And in Bridge to Terabithia, my son's best friend had been killed very tragically, and so the question all of us has, why would such a terrible thing happen?
Tell us more about that, because this children's book that you've written was based on a horrible story in your own life.
Well, David's, when he was in the second grade, his best friend was a girl named Lisa Hill. And the summer after their second grade, she went to the beach, and she was up on a rock dancing. Mm-hmm. She was just that kind of free-spirited little girl, and a bolt of lightning struck this little child up on a rock and killed her. And you take something that happens and you have no, it seems to have no meaning at all. And by the time you come to the end of the story, even though you can't rationally explain what this tragedy has meant, emotionally you've come from a place of total chaos to a place of meaning. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason when the book is challenged and criticized that I'm not so shaken by it as the hundreds of letters I've gotten over the years from people of every age to say what a comfort the book has been to them, having gone through some tragedy of their own, whether it's the death of their cat or the death of their grandparent or the death of their best friend or their parent. And since I know how much the book has meant to so many people, then I just, even though I'm very sad that it's offensive, if a book does not offend anybody, it probably has no power to comfort or help anybody either.
Catherine Patterson is author of Bridge to Terabithia, winner of the Newbery Medal. Thanks so much for coming in to talk to us.
Well, it was delightful to talk to you, Robin. Thank you.
And Catherine Patterson won that Newbery Medal in 1978. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producer, Lindsay Kudel. Our interns, Danielle Dreilinger and Jennifer Miller. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.